looked around. Didn't see any familiar face, and I knew that I was in the wrong place. I went around until I finished all the committee rooms. Then I had to phone. Then I was told that I must come back here. That's where you are. Now, I think let's just get straight to the business of the day, because I don't think we have much time, but that does not suggest that the presenters must rush their presentation and not do justice to it, because I complained about time. We'll see what we can do. So we welcome you to the committee and hope that the views that you'll be sharing with us will assist us to be able to do what is necessary to be done for us to come to the end of the problem of labor brokering. So with those few words, I don't think there's a need for introduction, because I think we know most of the members who are here. There's a new member who has been part of this member for the past few years, who has just joined us now, Comrade Eric Mjali, who is a stalwart of the ANC, also stalwart of the labor movement. Many people don't know him. When they see him, yes, they just see he's a very quiet person, unassuming, but is one of the brains behind the formation of COSATU during Saturday in Netai. I think in those few words, Honorable Mjali, welcome again in this committee. And there's another member, Nokaya. Mm-hmm. Nokaya Mnisi. Welcome, Comrade Nokaya. Without knowing your background, but I trust that there is no way that they can put you in this committee without knowing the value that you are going to add in this committee. So definitely, we welcome you in the committee. That's all that I can say. Other people are here, people from the department, and the people who are going to be presenting, that is Sharon and Colette. So when you talk, at least people will tell us who's talking, so we'll get to know each other. I think we should start. Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members of the Controlling Committee, for the invitation. My name is Sharon Marquardt-Jason. I work for the Center for Rural Legal Studies, and I'll just briefly introduce the team.
I'm Juliette Cotman. I'm the Deputy Director of Women on Farm Project in Stellenbosch.
Thank you, Chair. I don't know if I sit really, everybody will see me, or exactly if I stand. We thought that instead of the report...
You can sit down.
I can sit down.
Yeah,
okay,
we can hear you.
Okay. Mm. Two things that we have distributed to you. The one is the copy of the paper copy of the input, and a briefing paper which we've just last night finished off, and it's a summary of the bigger report which we'll be launching on Thursday. So an electronic copy would be available, which is much more detailed. Just briefly in terms of the content, Just very briefly, we talk about the organization. The context of the agricultural sector is very important, so we'll talk about that. We'll briefly talk about the methodology. But particularly when we speak about the methodology, it's particularly having the conversation in the context of what is the South African legislative framework and also that of the ILO, and we'll briefly look at international case studies. Because other countries have also dealt and are still struggling with these issues. Then we'll look at the key research findings, and part of the research process has been to look at what are the policy options, so that the research is not just take a sketch a picture of what is there, but also contribute to a debate to how do we move forward. And at the end of the chair, there's we available for questions, but also to participate in the discussion if you still require. The Center for Rural Legal Studies, we've started in 1991, and we started working on with farm workers around land and labor issues. We do research, we give legal advice, particularly around labor matters, and the labor matters with tenure security, of course, is the close link. Education around and training around workers' rights in particular, advocacy and lobbying, and then we work with a whole range of partners. The Women on Farms project was established in 1996, but actually operated before that already in 1992 as a project of the Voice for Human Rights, particularly focusing on farm worker issues. And Women on Farms has been and continues to be instrumental in mobilizing and organizing women farm workers. Some of the areas they look at is women's health, women's leadership, workers' rights, but that's not all. It's a whole broader around policies and so on. The context of the agricultural system. The commercial agriculture has been able to have the prominence in our economy because of under the colonial system, the slavery system that existed, that people were bonded labor, and out of that were from generation to generation continued working on a farm. And that's how, that was the beginnings of the commercial agriculture. Under apartheid, the notion or the system of subsidized labor supply continued. Now, the preference, the labor preference system, particularly in the Western Cape, has been one, and that's why the skewedness of the demographic profile of workers on most of the fruit and wine farms in the Western Cape area in particular is dominantly or predominantly colored. But that is also shifting and has been shifting significantly in the last couple of years. So coming from a background of slavery, moving into the paternalistic relationships that just flourished under the apartheid system and a bonded labor system, what we still have and still sit with is a very strong paternalistic relationship between employer. And when I say employer, we're talking about an employer now is going to become even wider because we're talking about labor brokerage. But if you think in terms of employer from the position of farmer, on-farm, farm worker community, then that has been, you know, dependent on the farmer for all their needs, the right to move around, the right to visit friends, the right to buy food, right of association. Had to come through the approval of the farmer then. And that is the key thing because later on when we talk about our labor legislation, it's built on the assumption that there's a highly organized and an aware of their rights work or labor force that are able to negotiate and advocate for better working conditions, and it's within an environment where that has not been fostered for generations. The low mobility, then of course, is also that it limits in terms of social skills, but also building up social capital outside and off farm and outside of a small community, whether that's communities, an informal settlement, wherever. The agriculture has been characterized by being very male dominated. That has shifted tremendously the last decade, and that has been coming out more and more in all studies, because we've seen the feminization of the labor force. But your permanent workers are still predominantly male. So permanent workers with contracts, therefore enjoying and having access to all the rights and benefits that a permanent work contract offers, is then, of course, excluded, where women farm workers are excluded because they are then on either short-term contracts or seasonal labor, or in the conversation of the research, migrant labor. Now, the last bullet point, less than 5% at the national level of farm workers are unionized. It's a bit over-generous with the truth at this point. The last 5 years, we've seen significant, and the 5% is a Kusatu FAU stats of about 4 years ago, and then it was already on the downslide, that it's possibly now at 3 and even less. And so in the deliberation chair for the committee, in looking at or exploring how can the legislative framework either be tightened up or changed, that if our set of labor legislation is based on the premises of of organized, unionized workforce that has the ability to negotiate. So on each farm, a farming unit being able to do that, in the context of a continual casualized contractual labor workforce, that raises serious concerns whether that is in actual fact a viable option. The methodology, just briefly, in terms of the research, we've looked at focus groups, interviews with labor brokers, farmers, and Department of Labor officials. The focus groups were with about 107 farm workers. Just briefly, in terms of the limitation of the study, the one is the geographic scope, but it's also a yes and a no. It was focused on the Grabouw area only. Now, Grabouw is one of the most densely populated deciduous fruit areas, farming areas. But one can say is a fair reflection of what could possibly be there in the rest of the province. Now, one can make further extrapolation if we've extended that, but we were very concerned when we started seeing the increase of workers coming whose rights have been violated, coming to both women on farms and the Center for Rural Legal Studies. And we started saying, this is a serious concern. It was also then shortly when we saw the sharp increase of people coming and saying they've worked for a whole month, and then they get dumped along the road, and they don't know the name of the farmer, they don't know the name of the broker, and they don't know how to get home. And Colette may, later on share around one particular case study of a migrant worker that has were killed, and neither the broker or the farmer wanted to take responsibility to. So when we started seeing all of this coming out, we were saying that we needed to look at it. Deal with it. The one concern that we do have is that the limitation of the study is that that there is not a clear and a sharper focus on gender and women farm workers in particular, given the context that most of the people that usually are employed as migrant and as seasonal labor are women. Now, the reason for the weakness in the study is that we could not start with the field work earlier, so we started during the thinning season. Now, the thinning season, because within the apple industry there are particular peak of when extensive labor is required, and the thinning season is one of it, but it's a very short, specific, and far more labor intensive, and therefore, you know, there were more men that were involved in the in that we got as part of the study at that time. And of course, with the commodity, sorry, that was you know, just focusing on food. So we haven't looked at any of the studies in the rest of the country where migrant labor is also being used. We looked at international case studies. Sorry, I think I may have swapped this one around. I just want to do this one first. The South African Legislative Framework. We've got the BCA, the LRA, that gives a definition of what is standard employment relationship. It gives a definition around temporary employment services. With the standard employment relationship in particular, it does not recognize sufficiently, and therefore what's covered in the BCA and the LRA doesn't sufficiently cover a tripartite relationship. Now, on the one hand, one can argue that the legislation is quite clear in terms of under temporary employment services, the labor broker is then seen as the employer. But what happens on the farm is that the worker comes, being brought there by the broker, starts working, and many of the cases that we've dealt with, if the farmer's not happy or something has happened with that relationship, the farmer fires the worker. And once the farmer has fired the worker, the labor broker has to comply with that. And that's where the confusion comes in. And once I start also referring to and talk about the international case studies, you'll see that it's also a problem that's being experienced at different levels. The collective bargaining under the LRA does not cover casual and seasonal workers. The lack of a distinction between employee and independent contractor, and particularly with the labor broker involved in that too, is then, you know, is the labor broker independent contractor? And when we start talking, and Colette will talk about the profile of the labor broker, you'll start seeing why it is even far more hazy and unclear. Our legislation doesn't provide an imperative for the employee and contractor to be being held jointly liable for the working relationship. And under the current legislative framework, our farm workers are being exploited by labor brokers, and increasingly we see the vulnerability taking place. Now, at the international level, the ILO, International Labour Organization, has got two key, or at least we've pulled out three of them, the Fourth Labour Convention, that's in 1930. Now, the way that they have defined forced labour, it also includes where you are being limited to, in terms of your movement of when can you go off, where can you go to. If you, the forced labor is being defined that the moment you are moved from one place to another, you're not able to bring, you're limited to bring your family there, that you don't have the ability to negotiate for better conditions, that even when you do want some better conditions such as accommodation and transport to association outside of the workplace, when the moment that becomes limited, it's being seen by the ILO defined as part of the forced labor. And that is together with the 1957 one that's been further amended. But in 1997, the ILO recognized that labor brokerage or the selling and the marketing of labor is a key part of the labor regime. And they brought out the framework looking at private employment agencies. And just to point out that South Africa has not ratified this, so has not agreed to that particular thing. And I'll leave it at that. I'm sorry, I just need to go back to the previous one. So the international case studies, we've got in the full report there's four, and I just want to deal with, in terms of time, the three. In Australia, they've seen the last decade an increased rate of casualization, but they've also looked at it as the industry itself were experiencing structural changes. So people use different terms in terms of downsizing, right-sizing, if HR stuff isn't, and managing the labor force isn't part of our work and our core business, then hand that out. So Australia has been dealt, and particularly with Australia, it's been the an element in all the countries has been that, and the ILO speaks about it in their convention, is that usually the people who engage us in migrant labor are those who have extreme poverty, usually are not aware of their rights, have very little negotiation ability to negotiate around better working conditions, and being further removed from their communities and their support bases, it's then even far more vulnerable and dependent on the labor broker to be to give that support. In the full electronic research report, there's a case study in particular of a South African worker that has worked as a migrant laborer in Australia, that died there, and then what happened consequently, and how the difficulty was to get compensation, and just for the employer to admit and recognize that they have a responsibility. In the U.S., particularly agricultural sector, is largely dependent, has become largely dependent on migrant workers, mostly Hispanic, from Mexico, and it's been characterized by most of the remuneration going towards transportation and accommodation costs, which is extremely high. The U.S. has responded by regulating labor brokers. So they have a very strict registration process. The person who, the broker, has to post bonds. So we have to say, you know, X number of workers we'll be using for this season or for this year. They actually have to put that money down against it so that if there's any default question or case against them, then there's money. And that they, together with the client, so in our case, the client we're talking about is the farmer, together with the farmer are then held jointly liable and responsible for whatever ensues out of a relationship that has gone wrong. In Namibia, so a bit closer home, in the 1990s, they started seeing what they refer to as labor hire and started seeing the increase of labor being contracted out. They've also seen the similar to South Africa, how unclear workers are in terms of who is really the employer. Particularly the one case that we focused on, it became clear that one of the reasons it's a cost thing, but it's also exploitative. Our analysis. Exploitative relationship, because easily a seasonal migrant worker would earn something like 480 per month, as opposed to what a permanent worker would be earning at 1,200. And a lot of the other costs goes off towards transportation, administrative fee, and accommodation, and whatever else. Other needs, and usually there's loans for food while they're staying on the farm or staying in the broker's accommodation that's being provided. Now, in Namibia in 2007, they introduced a labor act that prohibits labor hire. So, effectively, what they've done is to ban labor brokerage. And the African Personnel Services has challenged that last year, and in the Constitutional Court, it's now the Constitutional Court upheld the law and said that there is no basis for labor brokerage because the law doesn't allow it, and now it's on appeal. It's at the Supreme Court, so we're all quite anxious to see what the outcome of that will be.
I'd also like to reiterate what Sharonda did and thank the Portfolio Committee for the opportunity to present our research findings to you, share ideas, and hopefully to have a constructive engagement around some of the issues that are highlighted by the research findings. I'm going to just go through some of the clusters of the research, some of the finding clusters. So first of all, when we're looking at brokers, I think there is in many quarters a perception that brokers are rich, big business people. But in actual fact, in the sample that we studied, which is quite, we feel, representative of other areas, labor brokers are largely male, and most interestingly, they are former farm workers themselves, and very often while working on farms, held supervisory or managerial positions on the farm, and thereby acquired a certain degree of management skills and so on. And so they are by no means rich, big business people at all, and in fact, many of them are really struggling to break even. And when we ask them about what were their reasons for leaving farm work and becoming labor brokers, they said either the farms where they'd been employed had started retrenchment, so they really just opted to leave, or alternatively, they were, about to retire, and we know that retirement provisions being what they are, really non-existent for farm workers, they were looking for an alternative way to supplement their income before final retirement. And of course, they too had believed, had hoped that they would be their own bosses, that they would be able to make a decent living, but the reality is rather different from that. Like I say, they're struggling. Many of them also live in the same township that the contracted workers are also from. The other thing that we did find is that there are very, very few women labor brokers. And I think if you connect it to the fact that most farm workers, especially managerial positions, are male, so there really is on most farms really a glass ceiling to what women can do. So tractor drivers, managers, and so on farms are largely male. So in terms of women acquiring the necessary competencies around management, around basic bookkeeping, etc., women farm workers don't have that opportunity. So therefore we see that in terms of their preparation, in terms of their networks, they're not really set up by the time they leave farm work to open a labor brokerage. In terms of the worker profile, as Sharon said that historically speaking, most farm workers have been so-called colored and have been from the Western Cape. But increasingly in the last decade, we've seen that the demography is changing. And with respect to migrant workers or to labor broker contracted workers, most of them are migrant workers and usually from the former Transkei. And this is very important because obviously it adds another level of vulnerability to their conditions. They are literally fetched from Transkei, brought here. They don't have any social networks very often. They are on their own. They leave their families behind in the first instance. And really, to a great extent, they are at the beck and call of the labor broker, completely beholden to the labor broker. We also found, interestingly, there's a definite link between race, class, gender, and geographic origin. So in other words, just to, and I'll come back to this in another slide, in general terms, migrant workers are female, African, and from outside the Western Cape, from the former Transcat, whereas permanent workers are largely so-called colored, they are from the Western Cape, mainly from the Gqeberha area, and they are then permanent workers. So we can see that in terms of the status of the contract, it does have race, gender, and geographic overtones as well. When we looked at the minimum wage and contracts, farmers felt that they generally paid the labor broker enough for the labor broker to pay the minimum wage to the farm worker. However, they suspected that many labor brokers were in fact pocketing more than they were entitled to, and thereby actually paying the worker less than the minimum wage. However, the farmers didn't have any verification system. It was just, you know, they suspect that this is what is happening. And in fact, when we asked, well, you know, it is not your responsibility to check whether they are being paid the minimum wage, they said, no, we really think that it is a function of the Department of Labor to be making sure about this. With respect to contracts, we found that 95% of farm workers do not have any form of contract with the labor broker that they're employed with. And as you can imagine, this is a very first step of legal recourse. If you don't have a contract, you don't have a foot to stand on. So, and this also very often has other implications. It means very often that you don't know how long you're going to be working for, how many days a week. You don't know how much you're going to be paid. You don't know, you have no idea of what your labor conditions and tenure are going to be like at all. And interesting enough also, though, 42% of labor brokers also didn't have contracts with farmers. So although farmers are in some ways, renaming in respect ways with regard to the farm worker, but also they are not entering into contracts with the labor broker. So again, you know, if you look at it in terms of the chain, that means that the labor broker is also vulnerable, which will then later on translate into increased vulnerability for the farm worker.
Just to fit that, how is the labor broker vulnerable?
Okay, because the labor broker is obviously hired or contacted by the farmer.
Could you go back to that slide? Nothing sparked in our presentation with on that slide.
Okay. I think this is the last step, the 42%, yeah? Basically, it is that the labor broker is contacted by the farmer. So the contextual, let me say, relationship is between the farmer and the labor broker. And obviously then the labor broker is contacted by the farmer to then source laborers, farm workers. However, what is happening is that the farmer in that relationship, in that negotiation with the labor broker, is not entering into a formal written contract with the labor broker. So he is also entering into an informal verbal relationship with the labor broker. So the labor broker himself also doesn't know how much is the farmer going to be paying me, how long is the farmer going to be requiring my services to source labor, what are the financial obligations that the farmer has, what are the issues of liability, should I get sick or the worker get sick or so on. So because the labor broker doesn't have a contract and is himself vulnerable or subservient to the farmer, this means that the labor broker can't also then give any kind of contractual promises to the farm worker that he is employing, because he also doesn't know how long are we working on this farm for, how long are we going to be needed. So he also can't give any guarantees or assurances to the contracted farm workers. Coming back to the issue of gender and race, really the main issue here again to make is the fact that most, in general terms, most permanent male workers generally earn much more than female seasonal or female temporary workers. And this differential is actually exacerbated when you think about the fact that seasonal workers or temporary workers generally do not get any of the non-wage entitlements that permanent workers get. So they don't get paid, like today, training, none of them are being paid today. They don't get any of the, you know, like maternity or any of the other social benefits that permanent workers are entitled to. So not only in wage terms is there a differential between a permanent male worker, but also when one factors in the non-wage benefits between the two categories of worker. What we also found in our research is that all of the farm workers that we spoke to had not received any kind of training about their labor rights. So obviously, consequently, they had very little knowledge of what their labor rights were. And I think maybe more specifically or of immediate urgency was the fact that they did not know what the minimum legal wage is. So obviously, just in terms of common sense, if you don't know what you are legally entitled to, it is just so easy for you to be exploited and so on. So we can see that lack of labor rights knowledge is again another dimension that adds to the vulnerability of seasonal or temporary farm workers, especially given that you are in a foreign context, a new context where you're not going to be asking questions and so on. But there is definitely, again, we talked about training and who should be providing training and so on, but there is definitely a need for farm workers in general, but temporary workers in particular, to be formally and regularly updated and informed about what the legal minimum wage is. With respect to unionization, I suppose it comes as no surprise that none of the temporary workers that we spoke to were members of the trade union. And in fact, they didn't have any knowledge about which trade unions were operating in the area and what was the procedure for becoming a member of a trade union. So obviously there's a bit of work there for our trade unions to be doing on their side. But also there is a perception that farmers and labor brokers do not approve of unionized workers. So farm workers, even when they do know of the existence of unions, will think twice about joining a trade union because they suspect it might jeopardize their continued job prospects, either with a labor broker or with a farmer who might say, I don't want unionized workers on my farm. So I think generally unions, largely in the farm worker sector, they do face particular challenges with respect to organizing farm workers. But as one can imagine, if you're talking about seasonal farm workers who might be in Grabo for 4 or 5 months of the year, how do trade unions actually mobilize and organize them? Given the fact that they don't have a regular income or whatever, how is the question of dues and membership fees and all of that, how is that going to work out? And I suppose the mere fact that they are physically not around for the whole 12 months of the year means that a trade unionist, an organizer, doesn't have the opportunity to establish a long-term relationship with such a mobile and transient labor force who are here today, but in 5 months' time they'll be perhaps back in the former Transkei. Although farmers in principle all agreed that it was a good thing to use registered labor brokers, however, in practice they admitted that there is widespread use of non-registered labor brokers. And for a number of reasons this might arise. One is the fact that, I mean, they gave a number of practical suggestions, mainly directed at the Department of Labor, about how the department can actually facilitate the registration of labor brokers. So, for example, having a public register of all the labor brokers in an area, the Department of Labor ensuring that labor brokers, know how to register workers for UIF and workers' compensation, that they provide regular training to labor brokers. So there, and in the detailed report, there is, seven or eight very specific recommendations or so from farmers about how the Department of Labor might help them stick to actually only making use of registered labor brokers. With respect to the statutory deductions, specifically what we looked at was UIF and workman's compensation. Only 50% of all the workers that we interviewed actually said that these deductions were being made from their wages. And when we asked labor brokers, well, why are you not deducting this money? They said, well, we don't know how to register. We're not getting any help or support or assistance from the Department of Labor in regard to how we go about this. It's a very convoluted, difficult process to register workers. The workers are also, again, very mobile, they're transient, etc. Some of them have false ID documents. So they gave a whole host of explanations, or some might call them excuses, why they do not register and do not make the deduction for workman's comp and UIF. They also said that very specifically, when they've been to the Department of Labor, Department of Labor officials cannot give them advice about what are the legal provisions that seasonal workers or temporary workers are entitled to. So even at that level, if they do make the effort of going to Department of Labor local offices, they find that officials don't really know themselves what are the entitlements and protections and provisions for temporary workers. With regard to other deductions from wages, we found that the most significant deductions are for transport and for loans. So basically, when a labor broker can either, through informal networks in the township, you can get workers in that way, but most of the time they go to the former Transkei on their own costs. This is the labor broker now. And then the farm worker who is contracted in this way does not obviously at that time have any upfront money to pay for the transport. Later on, the labor broker will deduct those transport costs from the worker's salary. That's the one thing. Secondly, also very often farm workers arrive and they literally have no money in their pockets. So for the first month or two, they are getting into loans with borrowing from the labor broker, and very often the labor broker is charging interest, or they are buying food directly from the labor broker at super inflated prices, and again that is deducted later on by the labor broker. So what we are finding is that not only are a host of very unclear deductions being made from worker salaries, but also they are getting into very long-term indebtedness with this labor broker. They know that the significant amounts are coming off their salaries. They don't know how long they're going to be indebted for, but at the end of the day, they're coming out with a fraction of what they should be earning because of these deductions. Another area is the issue about, we asked farm workers, so who is your employer? Is it the farmer or is it the labor broker? And more than 80% said that it is the labor broker. So on that, they were pretty certain who their direct employer is. However, almost in the same breath, they said no, but when it comes to responsibility for training us, that is the responsibility of the farmer. They also were aware that the farmer has the ability to overrule certain decisions of the labor broker. So they were also aware that there was a power differential between the labor broker and the farmer. So also in terms of when we're thinking about in terms of accountability and liability, there is confusion about who is liable. And I think, without going into the detail of it, but a couple of years ago, there was a case that came to Women on Farm via the Department of Labor, actually, that of a migrant, of a temporary worker from the Free State, who had landed up in the Stellenbosch area. He had been contracted by a labor broker to work on a farm, and he found his family in Free State, his mother in Free State, just suddenly after a while lost contact with him, didn't know how to contact him. The labor broker was elusive. The mother didn't know who the farmer is that her child is working for. Anyway, we were asked to try and find out what had happened to this young man. And the long and short of it was that tragically he had been stabbed and killed in Stellenbosch, and his body was in the mortuary. The labor broker was not claiming the body, was not making any kind of move to have the body transported back to the family in the Free State. The farmer, of course, said, well, it's not my responsibility. So the poor young man was lying in the mortuary, the mother not knowing what has happened to her child, and both the labor broker and the farmer saying, it is not my responsibility to get the boy back home. So I think this shows very, very clearly the real dangers of and the implications of this blurredness between who is accountable and who is liable, the farmer or the labor broker. With respect to power relations, because bearing in mind that labor brokers are former farm workers themselves, it's obviously, I think Sharon has talked about the paternalistic historical relations which exist between farmers and farm workers. And what we see now is that in this new relationship between labor broker and farmer, those same power relations are replicated or mirrored, so that the farm, the labor broker, is still behaving deferentially in a kind of yah-bah kind of way towards the farmer, although now they really are more or less equals. But, you know, there is still that internalized oppression that the former farm worker, now labor broker, takes into this new relationship. And this has very direct implications for the type of negotiations that he can enter into with the farmer. Because if you're going to be acting subservient or deferential towards the farmer, you're not really going to be asserting your power and demanding a living, decent contract from the farmer, but rather accepting the terms that the farmer is presenting. So we're seeing that is also another area where labor brokers, in terms of mindset, there has to be a shift. Also, those same relationships of inequality are also now transferred into the relationship between the labor broker and the farm worker. So although the labor broker is himself a former farm worker, suddenly when he's a labor broker, he's also a bit baas-spielerig. So he's also playing boss with the farm workers and almost behaving in the same way as he was treated when he was a farm worker. He's almost, again, mirroring those same patterns that he received from the farmer, and is replicating that in the new relationship. And the implications for the farm worker is that they, even when they do know their rights, because they are so beholden to the labor broker, they are not asserting their rights, they are not challenging him when he's not paying them what they're entitled to, etc. They too are just subservient and accepting of those relationships. Generally, farmers have said that they use labor brokers because they then can avoid all the logistical issues that are needed. For instance, they don't have to go to the Transkei to contract workers. They don't have to drive around in the informal settlement in Gabon looking for farm workers. They kind of contract that out to the labor broker. In terms of the other administrative requirements, like registering this mobile workforce for UIF, that's also not their baby. It's now the responsibility of the labor broker. So it's definitely those are the two issues that they mentioned. So there is a clear and explicit mindset from the farmers to say, actually, by contacting a labor broker, we can circumvent all the requirements that are necessary when you are employing temporary workers. There's also a perception in terms of why migrant workers. When we think about Rabo, there is a high rate of unemployment, local unemployment. So why go all the way to the Transkei to employ workers for 4 or 5 months? And both farmers and labor brokers said farm workers from Transkei are more docile, they're more reliable, they work hard, and so on. And I think when one looks at the subtext of that, basically it also can be interpreted that farm workers from there don't know their labor rights, won't assert their rights, don't have access to networks and unions and so on. So our interpretation is that they are an especially exploitable workforce because of their vulnerability by coming from far away. With respect to accommodation, we often have access to farm workers, resident farm workers, their housing situation and so on. But the housing and the accommodation of temporary workers is generally much worse. It's a much more inferior standard to permanent and resident farm workers. So largely they are in hostels, or else they also just live in informal settlements near the labor brokers. With respect to women in particular, they reported on very specific issues around their privacy, around security, because very often the conditions in these hostels, or if you are living near the labor broker, it's very dark, you don't have privacy, you are sharing a room with strangers. So there are lots of gender-specific issues that women reported with respect to the poor accommodation. So that, in a nutshell, is really the summary of the most important research findings, and as Sharon said, the detail is in the bigger report, and that will be on our website, and we'll launch the report say after tomorrow. But part of the report was also to look at what are the policy implications given the description of the present status quo. What does this mean going forward for policies, for legislation, and so on? I think anyone looking at the status quo that we've just described, I think there can be no contestation about the fact that seasonal workers and temporary workers are very vulnerable, they're being exploited, they're not being protected by current legislation. So I think that if we are talking about policy implications, I think that from a human rights point of view, there is no question about the fact that we cannot leave the situation unchanged. So what does that mean for going forward? What does banning look like? First of all, I think that COSATU and other trade unions are making very impassioned and very reasoned arguments for just saying, let us ban labor brokers outright. Mm-hmm. And the objective of such a ban would obviously be to end the exploitation of temporary farm workers. And when one looks at the pernicious nature of the exploitation that is going on farms, one can totally see that on an emotional level, and so on, it makes sense. Let's just get rid of the labor brokers and stop this exploitation. However, there are certain risks and certain potential problems that relate to an outright ban. The first would be labor brokers might very well just be driven underground. So legally, they might be banned. However, they could just take on a different form and work in an underground, unregulated kind of way in the township and, you know, very surreptitiously still be going to the Transkei to recruit workers. And I think the question of banning also has implications for the Department of Labor. Given the fact that we already complain about enforcement and monitoring by the Department of Labor on farms, so by adding a new responsibility, you know, it's just not going to make any sense for a ban to really be enforceable by the Department of Labor. Sharon has talked about the constitutional challenges that Namibia faced, and I think that if we were to go down the banning route, we might also face similar constitutional challenges from labor brokerage companies who might say, this is not constitutional, etc. So that could be one of the risks involved. And lastly, it is also out of step with the international trend and the international norm. Sharon has outlined that talks a little bit about the ILO, and related to the ILO's acceptance of the regulation of labor brokers, I think it's also an implicit recognition that labor brokerage, contract work, temporary work, is the way of the future. That labor brokerage is not going to disappear. Temporary workers are not going to disappear. Before, that used to be the exception, but increasingly that form of employment is becoming the norm. So in terms of international case studies, it really is how do we deal with this changing employment phenomenon, which includes casual workers and which includes labor brokers. So if banning is not going to be a feasible option, what about regulation? And to us, in our way of thinking and looking at international case studies and the ILO, we think that this regulation is probably the most enforceable way to go in the future. And more importantly, it will then also have the advantage of addressing the current legislative gaps that we have, which Sharon has outlined, and which I will come back to. But, you know, things like how casual workers and so on are excluded from bargaining, how labor brokers are defined. Are they the employees, the farmer, the employee? Are labor brokers employees, or are they employers? So on. So regulation would address some of these ambiguities. And more importantly, it will put a very specific legal framework in place so that there is no gray area about liability, accountability. Perhaps the labor broker and the farmer are jointly and severally held accountable and liable, etc. But also I think this would then make the work, for instance, of the Department of Labor much more doable and enforceable, because there would be a clear legal framework regulating the practices of labor brokers. Most importantly, of course, it would protect the rights of temporary farm workers, and also reflect the fact that we are keeping reflecting the international trend and the international norm regarding labor brokers and temporary workers. However, in order for this to happen, there are a number of things that have to take place, that have to be put in place, a number of requirements. So first of all, there has to be a very comprehensive review of our existing legislation. Sharon has just touched on a few of the gaps that we have at the moment. One of the main ones is around the fact that our present legislation is predicated on this standard two-way relationship between an employer and an employee. Finished. Now, however, we are seeing a relationship where there's a three-way relationship between the farmer, the labor broker, and the farm worker. So just in very broad terms, that's kind of the starting point that we have to approach the review of current legislation for. The Labor Relations Act, there are various definitions and so on that have to be looked at in terms of, when we talk about temporary employment services, how temporary is temporary? At the moment, we've got permanent temporary workers. So should there not be a clear cutoff about when does temporary cease being temporary and then move over to being permanent? So really there needs to be a comprehensive audit and overhaul of what our current legislation is saying. And then following on that, once we've established the gaps and so on, we then need to bring into place very specific legislation that will look at the issue of labor brokers and temporary workers. Regarding enforcement, and this is really more very specific with regard to the Department of Labor, but no matter what fantastic laws and what regulatory frameworks we put into place, unless they are enforced, they're not going to be worth the paper that they are written on, and the exploitation of farm workers will continue. So when we're looking at the enforcement, obviously we're talking immediately especially about the Department of Labor, what is required from their side. First of all, there is definitely, I think, a need to expand and to improve the capacity of the department. And by that, what do we mean? That the officials must really be on top of legislation. They must be able to advise labor brokers. They must be able to give training to labor brokers and a host of other things which are very specific. Very importantly, they must also go out to the farms. So at the moment, we know, for instance, that there isn't regular monitoring and inspection of farms, largely due to capacity constraints and so on. But the bottom line is that there are all kinds of labor rights violations that are able to take place because there is no regular inspection and enforcement. And related to this, then, regarding capacity, is that we know at the moment that there are not sort of sector-specific inspectors. One way of getting around this or addressing this would be to have agriculture-specific inspectors, so that inspectors that are only responsible for inspecting farms and agriculture and pack houses and so on. And another thing would also make a lot of sense is that organizations like CRLS, the trade unions, Women on Farms, have established networks on farms with farm workers. So again, rather than reinventing the wheel, it would make a lot of sense if the Department of Labor could work closely with these civil society formations in terms of facilitating the process of enforcement and so on. Great. That's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. It's now the time for our comments, questions, and clarities, so that we can have a discussion on the presentation. Honorable Olive.
Thank you, Comrade Chairperson. I've got 7 questions. Do you want me to ask 3 and then another 3, or must I ask all 7?
No, just ask.
Go ahead, okay, thank you. Wow, that was quite a presentation. I've learned some things this morning, so thank you very much. I'm quite wowed by that. I want to ask a number of questions, so maybe I'll just list them for you and then you can respond. The first one is, you spoke about the change in the patterns, and there's one particular change that interests me because it might offer us some hope amidst all the doom and gloom. You spoke about the fact that the temporary workers used to typically be coloured women, if I can use that expression, and now you're typically seeing black people from the Transkei are typically. How did that change occur? Because what the question that I immediately want to ask is, where did those coloured women go? Have they now become permanent employees in farms as a result of whatever? And that's the thing that I want to try to get to grips with. Did that temporary work eventually become permanent work? Or have those coloured women become unemployed? I'm trying to understand that, because that's quite important. Secondly, these labour brokers, I didn't realise there were so many marginal or quite poor labour brokers, which is news. It's a whole new thing to me to understand. Do they really, these poor or marginal, should I use the word, labour brokers, personally get in their car and drive to the Transkei to recruit people? I would have assumed that they would be trying to recruit from some of the squatter camps and informal settlements around the area, or even in this province. That's news to me. Enforcement is a big word. I think every time we've had a presentation since I've been elected, we've had questions asked about the Department of Labor's ability to enforce. There seems to be a capacity problem here as well. Is it a question of too few inspectors? Is it a question of poorly trained inspectors? Is it a question of transport? They're not going out just sitting in the office. And then, in terms of those labour brokers, you're proposing that instead of banning them completely, that we regulate the industry in various ways. If they are marginal brokers and we don't hear from them, we don't know what their needs are. So let's say we decide we're going to regulate their industry. And I think that we should, obviously. Should we not be listening to one or two of them personally? I mean, should we not invite them to our committee to tell us what they think? I don't know if you have some suggestions there. And then you spoke a lot about unions, and there seems to be the assumption in your presentation that the answer to a lot of problems is to unionize everybody. Do you see that as the only way to have constructive engagement between workers and employers, is to unionize them? I'm just concerned that this parliamentary committee then becomes an arm of the trade union movement instead of a legislative body, where our job is not to make sure that everybody gets unionized, but our job is to try to protect workers' rights. And those two things are not always the same thing. I mean, we can legislate, we can have inspectors, we can get the Labour Department to actually do their job better. There are all sorts of things open to us as vehicles. And then just that thing about the body in the morgue interested me, because it's a situation that is unusual, you know, and when we legislate, we have to think also in terms of all the different implications of the legislation. So what will work really well to solve that problem in the Western Cape might work less well if we have, say, a worker coming from Australia to work in an office in Sandton and the person dies at work. The results might be quite different. The employer might phone Australia and say, you know, your sister has passed away, what would you like me to do? But your implications seem to be that the employer should pay for and arrange the transport of the body back. Is that something that happens elsewhere? I'm not sure. I'm asking a question. Thank you, Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Honourable Ollis. Honourable Tikeledi.
I just want to say if the research did look into the schooling for the children of farm workers, especially permanent workers, and of course child labor. And looking at the state of income and social conditions of farm workers, obviously the level of poverty is too high. In the lack of this information, what would like to get info regarding the state of infant health and infant mortality rate? And with farmers not knowing their rights, do you monitor if they do apply for their UIF at the end of the contract? And the last one, I think, is just a comment on partnering with trade unions. I really don't see trade unions relating potential members to labor brokers. So that one is very difficult for me, for trade unions to work hand in hand with labor brokers instead of them recruiting potential members of the union.
Any further questions? Honourable Verma.
Thanks, Honourable Chairperson. Thank you to the two presentations. I think it doesn't matter whether labour workers are rich or whether they are poor. We still see the exploitation of people happening. The more people are becoming vulnerable due to this practice happening. I have many questions, so I'll start. A comment, not a question for you to answer, but a comment. Selling and buying of the worker, isn't that a nice way of human trafficking? Isn't that a nice way of putting it? Okay, that's just a comment, and you can comment on that if you want to. Then my other question, seasonal workers. I just want to know, me as a labor broker, I do the paperwork through experience, and you're saying that there were former workers on the farm. Now, that labor broker, do they keep paperwork? Do they keep track of seasonal workers, especially women? Okay. When you say more and more seasonal workers are women and men are more permanent workers, now seasonal workers, when women are pregnant and they are working and they're doing seasonal work and they need to go away, now the broker, obviously I know that she needs to come back. Can she come back the next season? Does it work that way? So paperwork, keeping track of seasonal workers that need to be done. So is there a track of paperwork? Is there a track of paperwork? Like contact numbers, addresses and so forth. Can the woman come back to that seasonal job, maybe next year? Can she apply in that time that she's gone for UIF and so forth? Then thirdly, you spoke about the USA, and they have regulated labor brokers. And I'm just wondering, if they are regulating, or is it to the benefit of the worker, and how is it to the benefit of the worker, or is it to the benefit of the labor broker? I just need some clarity there. Okay, yeah, thanks. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Honorable Velma. Honorable Lusizo.
Thanks, Chair. I want to welcome this study which is presented before us here this morning, and understand that this is just a study that was done in the Western Cape and mainly in the farm area around the Western Cape. And by looking at the study, you can see that the study is a representation, a true representation or reflection of the farming community in the Western Cape. Well, we may not know the methodology whether non-probability sampling or sampling was, or probability sampling was done in such a way as to make the study more scientific, as to go back and trace back the patterns or the answers that were given during the study. But all we can say as the labor committee said, we can see that there is direct exploitation of the worker, and this study is actually giving us a framework or something to work on, because, well, we understand here that in the study you have indicated that most of the labor brokers are also people that are struggling, but that does not actually, that will not be the case as to a labor broker that is in Sandton or labor broker that is operating in a mine. Those might as well be very wealthy labor brokers, and yet maybe here in the Western Cape we can see that the study has indicated that most of the labor brokers are actually retired or retrenched farm workers themselves. But the study gives us an indication of the level of exploitation amongst the farming community in the Western Cape. It might also not be the very same case as to the farming community in somewhere else around the country, but it is giving us indication of the levels of exploitation. Now, going to the legislation framework, we understand that the ILO has the legislation around private employment agencies, and we welcome the fact that South Africa has not ratified this, but up to us right now, we are saying labor brokers are operating illegally. So we need to find the legislation that will let them know that their practice is illegal from the point of departure. Whether we regulate it in whatever fashion or manner, it has to be understood that these are operating illegally at this point in time. And our point of departure would be to find means and ways of finding legislation around labor brokering that will benefit the masses of our people that are being exploited out there. Thank you.
Thank you, Comrade Chelsea. Honorable Nyakemba.
Thank you very much. And also thank the Center for Rural Legal Studies to make this informative presentation of the outcome of the research. I think the first point that was made by Honorable Verma, I link it with Section 22 of the Constitution of the Republic. I think the ongoing discussions, we need to take that into account. The existence of labor brokers, the question becomes, they are broking on what? Are they broking on insurances, or they are broking using human beings? I think it's the issue of Section 22 of the Constitution have a space in what Verma said. What I'm looking at here, in particular, the Free States example, that young man, is evidence enough that currently, as we speak, is not something that might happen if in the process Parliament can decide to ban labor brokers. That's evidence enough to say labor brokers are operating underground, as we speak. They are not waiting for them to be banned. The fact that there will be verbal agreements. I know that in terms of, if you look at the contract of employment, you will be told that a contract of employment does not necessarily mean that it has to be in writing. It can be entered into verbally. Now, if then there can be verbal business agreements, between a body that regards itself as an employer and another body which is also an employer. I think the question that they're raising in your study, who is an employer, is very relevant. Because obviously now you will be having two employers. You will be having your labor broker, you will have your farmer, you will have employees who do not know who is their employer, whether the labor broker or the farmer. So I think this is very much critical, and the exploitation, is evident. You made a point. In fact, I'm looking at these options. There's option one. Option one is cooking. But if I look at option two, there are motivations in the presentation of option two. anyway, it's the outcome of the research. Yeah, it's the outcome of the research. But I think the point which one wants to make here is that I think that something even the Department of Labor is looking at around the inspectorate issue of specialization. But not necessarily specialization in terms of sectors alone, but also in a number of operational issues, operational matters within an establishment. And I think your boy's fine expression in that regard. The last point, sir, that I want to make is that this presentation sometimes the disadvantage is that you get documentation in the meeting or in the presentation because there is this document here. Then it becomes difficult that you listen to the presentation, you look at the slides, and you also want to read this, and then you are told that this is a summary of a ticket document that is going to be launched on Thursday. You see, that makes us now not necessarily following examples of what needs to be done. But I think the Department of Labor is here, they will speak for themselves on a number of issues. But I think the approach currently is better because I'm not talking at the back of other committee members. We had our own strategic planning workshop for 2 days last week in looking at which areas of amendment in the labor legislation. Not necessarily only the issue of the labor broker is part of that, of course. But at the same time, we went to an extent where we feel that the ministries in the Department of Labor need to have, I'm not sure whether I will buy the, whether to say prerogative or a power for sectoral determination, in particular in the farm industry, as a sector and domestic, in order to deal with the vulnerability even of those permanent workers that are employed by farmers. Because we may say there are permanent workers in the farming sector which are better than the labor broker. One will find that even those permanent workers themselves, they are not better once they are being regarded as enjoying permanent employment status. The issue of unionization, it's a debatable issue, but I think it's there in the Act. There's nothing wrong for me, for a Department of Labor, for us, I mean, popularizing the rights that employees have, like the right of being a member of the trade union for that matter. So I think it's issue. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, members. Velma, you want to add something? Okay.
Yes, just before the answer. As it was said, we had a workshop 2 weeks ago. I'd like to hear from you, and what is your view? You are saying that nobody's taking accountability for what is happening, for example, the death or murder that happened, and, for example, the deductions of UIF or workers' compensation. So, for example, say a worker, and we have a worker in a workplace, and he has an employer. Sometimes the labor broker is working from his car. Maybe he has a laptop, and he has no office. So there is a dispute as to who the workers are working for. Are they working for the worker, or the farmer, or for the labor broker? So what is your view on that? Personally, I would prefer that the boss takes or the farmer takes responsibility for the work for workers, because they have my skills, my working skills are being used for the farmer, and he's working within the workplace. Okay, but the farmer is saying, I didn't employ you. The labor broker employed you. So now there's a dispute amongst us. So would you think should be accountable? Just your view on that. Who should be accountable? Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you, members. Can we allow the researcher, Sharon, and Colette to answer the questions that have been asked?
Okay. We're going to, between the two of us, try and answer, so I may take some of it. And if you feel at the end of it that we haven't responded to your question, please just raise it. I'll start with the shift in the demographic profile of the workforce and the question of what's happened to the colored women. Now, if you remember, or if you could think back to a few years ago, the Nkuzi research around evictions on farms, and has indicated more than a million farm workers have been moved off farms. Now, the Agri-SA has disputed that. But for an example, we've had a case of a farm worker who wanted us to assist him to get his money, and his UIF details and the employer registration number and all of that. And in just that conversation, he's been working on the farm. He's about 50 odd, been working all his life on farms, and have moved so many times. So in the lifetime of one worker, you can easily have, you know, that person moving 10 to 20 to 30 times. This particular person has, in the last year, moved to 5 different employments. And there are various reasons why that happened. So we have seen a significant number of people moving off farms. So it's not that they stay on farms and, you know, work contracts of a seasonal or a contract, a short-term contract gets moved over into permanent. No, because the moment part of what our legislation has, and I was listening to the honorable member talking about tightening up legislation, but we've also seen the consequences of it, and it's unintended consequences of the legislation. So that as the legislation like ESTA attempts, and sectoral determination attempts to tighten up and protect workers, the unintended consequences is that people become more vulnerable. That in actual fact, people are moved off farms before they reach 60, have lived and worked on a farm for 10 years. There's all kinds of stuff that happens. And even if they manage to stay on and 10-year security is awarded to them, they lose out on their family, because then your children can't be there and take care of you. In the big report, we've got case studies of, and in actual fact, sorry, not in the report, in Women on Farms' input to the Portfolio Committee for Rural Development and Land Reform, raise the issues of where people, even though they've got tenure on farm, if they're no longer working there, the farmer just comes and knocks on the door one morning and say, there are 3 casual laborers that's going to be coming here, and you need to make a room available, and their young children have to share the room. And only once those families decided to take action and go to Lawyers for Human Rights, then they said, so that is one family who knows and understands what their rights are. How many others is it that don't know? So part of the tightening up, we also have to be aware of what's happening. So we've seen a phenomenal off-farm pattern of people just leaving. And part of the leaving is that, so if I don't have the workers on the farms anymore, they're not my responsibility. And the phenomena is that the farm houses, laborers' houses are now the tourism, part of the tourism industry. So that's where what happens. Women and people who are, men who are moved off the farm, living in informal settlements, mostly unemployed, or depending on this verbal contract with the contractor. I want to just quickly touch on the committee member Wilmer has raised the issue of selling and buying of workers and of work. And that is exactly how the ILO defines in their forced labor, that that the taking people from one place and moving them to another, that you, if you remember our case that we've had around domestic workers in particular, coming from rural areas, it's a similar thing, and that is forced bonded labor, and the ILO is very clear about that particular issue. The tracking of seasonal labor, that's one of the areas that the labor brokers have indicated that they don't, they have very little time or the expertise to track seasonal labor. So the likelihood is that, you know, if the person has been a hard worker and has, you know, not complained, has been just accepted whatever conditions it's on, the likelihood is that the person may be invited back if they are to be part of the work party for the next year. Just briefly, my last point I want to respond to is around the USA case study. The attempt that the US case study with the regulating labor brokerage has attempted to protect the workers and make sure that if there's been an agreement around fair, but for your labor you will receive fair remuneration, and that fair remuneration is has been agreed, and there's a minimum standard that the legislation upholds, then to make sure that there's not problems afterwards, but that people in actual fact that there's money that's being posted against the use of that labor. So we're hoping that that it is to the benefit of the workers. There are a number of very horrifying stories that do come out. So I don't know whether that would be the best option, but it is an option to consider. The question around accountability of the labor broker and whether the labor broker is the employer or in actual fact the worker. Now, the labor legislation speaks about independent contractors. Now, if you're an independent contractor, you can work off-site away using your own tools, your own technology, your own administration to deliver a piece of work and then bring it back. And you sell that, or you've been contracted to bring back that piece that you've done. The confusion here is that your labor broker does not appear to be an independent contractor. The farmer determines when the work is going to happen, the time that the person is going to it, the fields that they're going to work in for that particular day, the tools and equipment that they're going to be using. At times also, and this is where the issue has come around the accidents that we've had, that the vehicles that's been used have been vehicles that the farmer has made available for transportation. Now, that raises a whole range of questions around, or concerns around, really how independent then is this independent contractor. And that adds to the blurriness of the legislation. I think I will hand over to you. Thank you.
Okay, I realize that we are short of time, so I'll be brief, but if you want more elaboration, we can also come back to some of the questions. So just taking it from the top, labor brokers, if they go personally to the Transkei, most of the time, yes, they do. Why they don't employ locally or recruit locally is that they do to some extent recruit locally, but the reason is because they see migrant workers as being more docile. and so therefore they rather would make that extra effort to recruit from the Transkei, where people are coming from a rural area perhaps and have had no contact regarding rights, and they're not going to ask any difficult questions and so on. So in some ways it works to their advantage to make that extra effort. However, very often once a farm worker has come, she or he might decide to stay on in the informal settlement. And so that is also one of the explanations that we see a growth in informal settlements where farm workers are recruited from. So the first year they come on their own, no family. Maybe in the second year, if they've got a bit of extra money, they'll send for one of their children or for a second child and so on. So it also relates to the question from the honourable member about the schooling of farm of children. In general, if they are going to join their mother or father in the informal settlement, then they go to school, you know, with the other children. And largely because they are not resident on farms anymore, so they are going to school on, you know, in the other school. However, related point regarding child labour is that we did find a small fraction of children aged between 15 and 18, so 16, 17 year old children, who were working. But now the issue comes in about how many hours per week they were working, whether the work they're doing can be defined as hazardous, and so on. So even there, in terms of our legislation, there also needs to be maybe a greater clarification and tightening on the whole issue about the definition of a child, the work hours a child is entitled to, and what constitutes hazardous work. Because at the moment they say a child cannot do hazardous work. So very often farm work is pretty hazardous, if you think about pesticides, if you think about the equipment they use, and so on. But again, there's a bit of a blurring regarding how that is defined. In terms of the Department of Labor, what the problem is to few inspectors, I think all of the issues are there. There are particular offices, especially in rural towns and so on, where Department of Labor officials are really strapped in terms of resources, in terms of their capacity, staffing, but also even in terms of transport. They literally just don't have enough transport to get out to all the far-flung farms. If you think about an area, you know, here in the Western Cape, to get from here to, or even from the local offices, from Powell or whatever, to here, it's a good couple of hours. So the distances and the transport requirements are great, and I think the offices are not coping with that. So there is definitely a need for expansion in terms of increasing of numbers, increasing of resources like cars, but also definitely a capacitation of the officials that we do employ. Labor brokers, about how do we know what their needs are? In this particular study, we spoke to labor brokers, and one of the things that did come from their side was that they also felt the need for the formation or establishment of associations, for want of a better word. And there are a couple of associations, but these again are not very organized, not everybody are members, and so on. So I think that from their side, there is also a recognition for some kind of organization which will then give them the added advantage of having a united voice when they are in negotiations with farmers. So it's not kind of a divide and rule playing one labor broker off against another, which is also what often happens. In terms of the portfolio committee, I think, you know, if we were to say, I think that you would definitely benefit from hearing their side of the story. I know the other honourable member has said that these labour brokers here are very specific in the fact that they were former farm workers. It certainly doesn't reflect the situation of labour brokers in other areas, in other sectors. But I do think, though, that bringing all these different labour brokers or types of labour brokers together would give the portfolio committee a better picture, a more comprehensive picture about what the totality of labour brokerage actually is in our country today. Various people have talked about unionizing, is it a solution? The portfolio committee obviously not being part of that, but in terms of our study, in terms of the work that we do, we are always going to call for and encourage workers to join a union. That goes without saying, because very often that is really step one in terms of a worker knowing their rights, and step two, having recourse should something go wrong. So we are certainly not seeing that as the panacea for every single problem that a farm worker faces, but definitely a unionized worker is a more powerful worker and is less likely to be exploited than a worker that is not unionized. Policy options, yes, I think that we definitely, you spotted it, that we do have the research is definitely coming down on one side of the equation, but I think really it is raised as a discussion point, that we've looked at banning in other contexts and we see what are the problems with banning. On the one hand, the advantages, on the other hand, what are the problems. So I do think that in this particular study, we certainly are thinking that regulation and enforcement of regulation is the way to go, but it really is a work in process, it's a document for also working a discussion point and so on. And like I said, we are very cognizant of the fact that Kusatu, for instance, is calling for an outside ban of labor brokers, and we can quite see why they would be doing that.
Oh, thank you. Any more questions? Honorable Law?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think we've touched on a number of issues regarding the labor broking issue, especially on the food farm. But you know, the analogy of exploitation, we cannot run away from that one. Exploitation is a factor to a certain degree. Now, my question here is, and I don't hear this coming out very clearly. You know, when we, if I should just go one step backwards, not very long ago, the National Credit Act came in because of also exploitation of people in the financial sector, where people have been exploited in terms of macho Lisa or the loan sharks or whatever we want to call that. And the moment when regulation came in, we start seeing that it's happening to a very lesser degree. I'm not saying that it's not happening anymore, but it's happening to a very less degree because regulation has been implemented. Now, in terms of responsibility, banning is a shortcut route to go, and that is not the alternative. One needs to look at other mechanisms and methodologies, which was actually highlighted by the presenters to us today. But one must also look at the responsibility. Who, at the end of the day, is responsible to make sure that these things are enforced, are working, and so forth? The Department of Labor has been failing us in this attempt. Nothing has been done from their side in order to make sure, that is my version, nothing has been done to make sure that at the end of the day, these people, they will exploit the system because there is no mechanism put in place to make sure that these people, they comply. In other words, there's nobody who's policing the system. Obviously, they will exploit it. Up until such time that people start realizing, and I'm referring now to the brokers, etc., that they realize that there are systems in place of compliance and enforcement, then these things will be... they will take place in a very large degree. But I think one needs to look at the ownership of responsibility. And my view is the Department of Labor, they also need to come in. Instead of just looking at one side of saying, you know, is banning not the solution? My version, I don't think that is really the way one should look into. And you will be mindful of the fact that every time when we touch on the subject, because it's a very touchy subject, I think regulation with enforcement, that would be the route to go. And I think that the ladies have already alluded to that as well, and that was just a comment that I would like to make in general. Thank you.
Take a look.
Tibetan. I see the presentation focusing mainly on the tradition of workers. It's of course an issue on this labor cooking system. But as part of the outcome, I think it also intends on the social aspect of the people, that is their welfare in general. If there was raising issues like infant mortality rate, or there's someone in the slide here where it says generations after generations become farm workers. But now on page one, under inclusive organization, it seems there is a group that will be focusing on women's health. And if you see the budget of government in all departments, additional budget, the major chunk is on the social welfare, because it is you know, the most challenging aspect if you compare to other departments. So we'd like to have more information on this women's health. Maybe the other group that are working with, as a member of the group, saying that we should invite more people working with yourself. Maybe they'll provide more information on issues of the social aspects.
Thank you, members. Is there anything that you want to say on the comments that have been made?
Thank you, Jay. Thank you for the comments. I think it's very valuable to hear you and have your insights. The issue of the social and broader rights aspects, with particular Colette referred to, made mention of it around the broader human rights violations, are key concerns for us. And we keep that in terms of this particular report, we've kept that to the background. But it definitely does impact. It impacts in terms of at a local level for a, whether it's a town of Krabowl that's got an increasing populace that's living in informal settlements, that has a irregular income and unsustained income, and that what happens is that the social capital and the ability to put money aside for schooling, for education, for health, better health care, it's constantly being eroded because nothing can be banked, nothing can be kept to one side. The implication, of course, is that we haven't even raised the issue around HIV/AIDS and the implication that will have on the workforce, and that will have generally on the economy of the country. We're not even talking specifically for the agricultural sector. So I think those are issues that are part of the landscape, but in terms of for the specifically for the objectives of the report, we needed to contain ourselves to those matters. The just the last comment that I would like to make around worker organizations, even though that we partner organizations, CRLS and Women on Farm, also the extent with Women on Farm strongly believe and go all out in terms of an assisted with Sekula Sonke, who has in the short space have got half of the national membership number that FAO has, who's been around for a number of years. But whereas our approach is that the premises of the labor legislation is very clear on the assumption that they are organized, knowledgeable workforce, that when their rights are being violated, somebody's going to pick up the phone, totally the assumption about having the resources and the infrastructure, which in many rural areas and in many farms does not exist, but have that ability to know who to contact and to get to the Department of Labor and make that complaint. And to persist with that complaint when the farmer or the employer says, no, that is not the case, or cover up. We have a situation where that does not happen. But yet, our legislation is very clear. We're clear about who is an employer, and if this is not clear, then go and complain. If you don't have a contract and you're being employed, you need to know who your, even if it's just a rough piece of paper that's written on, the name of the employer, the place of employment, the number as an employer, that's basic stuff that all of us don't even ask for. But when you have a verbal contract where you don't even know whether you've heard properly, and that the person may change that contract tomorrow, depends on what happens today on the farm or in the work situation, it further erodes the ability to negotiate and erodes that power. And for us, we're strong that workers need to be organized, but also that we need to have a trade union model that deals with the current reality, and that is that we have a huge part of our labor force that's on short-term contract or seasonally employed. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, members. There are a few comments and clarities that I would want to get from the presenters. When you were doing your presentations, you pointed out that there are labor brokers who are subjected to slavery conditions. Like you were saying that some of the clients, your third party, do not abide or do not want to make agreements with the labor brokers. So it is them at the end of the day who decide who to get. So I need clarity on that, because I don't want to say I heard you properly. Just explain to me that scenario where farmers become where labor brokers are treated like farmers themselves. You know, so there's something that I don't understand where you say they are also exploited. How are they exploited?
Really, they are exploited, I think, well, number one, in terms of their bargaining power and their ability to actually enter into a robust negotiation with the farmer. So the farmer is quite, on the one hand, the farmer needs the labor broker, because the labor broker will be supplying him with labor. So he does have that need. But he's also very aware that the labor broker is completely dependent on the farmer for a contract. And also because, in general, farmers tend to communicate and talk to each other a lot. So if you burn your bridges with farmer one, it's quite likely that you're not going to get a contract with the next farmer or the neighboring farmer and so on. So as a labor broker, you are not going to have a livelihood. So labor brokers are 100% dependent on a good relationship with a farmer to actually get a contract to provide labor to the farmer for the season. So that's kind of the one thing. However, it takes place in a sort of a historical relationship where the farmer still sees the labor broker as a former farm worker. So the farmer is still acting in that old historical, traditional relationship as the boss, the boss, literally, you know. And so he basically doesn't regard the labor broker as an equal business person, but really does implicitly still regard the labor broker as a farm worker and treats the labor broker accordingly. Unfortunately, on the other side of the equation, the labor broker still behaves like a farm worker. So still behaves in a very subservient and overly respectful way towards the farmer, not challenging, not asserting, not demanding, etc. So in that way, in a way, the old relationship that existed and which exists today between farmer and farm worker continue, unfortunately, in this new relationship between farmer and labor broker. And in terms of the exploitation of the labor broker, the farmer literally can decide, like Sharon says, how many days will you work. He can tell you, okay, I need workers for 10 days, but tomorrow, if he gets a cheaper labor broker, he can just
break his contract with you and say, I don't need you anymore. And so what are you going to do with all the workers that you got from the trans guys? The farmer is just going to move on to a cheaper labor broker. So we also see that farmers have the capacity to play one labor broker off against another because the labor brokers themselves are not organized and certainly don't necessarily speak with one voice. So in that sense is what we mean about the sort of the exploitative relationship between the farmer and the labor broker.
Okay. Now, just if you were to just, you were in a position to make changes in the law or given an opportunity to do that. I've listened to the presentation. The presentation is, though you see that this is a system where workers are brutally exploited, I mean, you cited the case of this Free State worker who came, you are killed. You also understand where COSATU comes from when they call for the banning of the labor brokers. But you are also sympathetic to some labor brokers or sympathetic to the system for the reasons that you have advanced. I fail to understand where do you stand. Now, if you were to advise us, what do you think is the best way of dealing with this? We should, do we ban? Or we don't ban, or we ban, and then do A, B, C, D, because you are saying that the law is focused on an employer and employee. Is there no gap in that? So what do you think, what are your specific proposals that should be considered by the committee? Specific, say, one within the one, instead of being general, because I don't want to open a debate, because to me, when you say the focus is on employer and employee, there'll be another question arises. Who is the employer? You yourself could not identify, and the experience in your own research that you're conducting, it was difficult to identify who's the employer. Now, what are your specific proposals to the committee? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. We hope our contribution is to get the debate going. But if we're able to change things, the one is to look at the existing and we're saying, well, from the start to be quite clear, or we're saying, banning is not going to have, outside banning is not going to have the desired, we think, not going to have the desired effect. And we've listed those reasons, driving them underground, a different face and format of it will come to the fore. So when we look at regulation, I mean, the difficulty was for us was to say we should be wary that we don't become sympathetic to labor brokers. Because this is just one profile of labor brokers that we've come across. And they were part of the conversation from the interview, 12 of them that were operating in the Gerbo area. So we were quite aware of it, that it's small, black, not even small, micro businesses, black businesses struggling to make a living. But that is not our focus. So there's an industry, and particularly the fruit sector, has got a structure that they've got set up, and they, because of the bad publicity that they got through labor brokers, decided they need to do something about it. If this is the route that their members, who supply the export forum, are taking, then the industry should. We come to assisting in building and developing the business, the business of the labor broker, training them in how to run a small business, becoming compliant with the employer, then that is what the industry needs to do. On the other hand, though, it's saying
So in terms of with Department of Labor, if we're talking about regulating, it means already that within the current framework of what the Department of Labor's mandate is, that our experience is that we're already not managing. So what is it that if we didn't just talk about regulation, what else is it that needs to be in place to make that possible? What kind of capacity and resources is it that a Department of Labor needs to have in order to enforce? That if one looks at it, you can look at multi-stakeholder kind of initiatives that could help spread monitoring and evaluation, but in the, at the end of it all, Chair, is that the that government, Parliament has got a policy and legislative mandate and responsibility, and the department, government department, Department of Labor in particular, has got the responsibility to ensure that it gets implemented. And civil society can give the feedback about what is happening, what is our experience, what do we hear on the ground, and make that possible. But if one looks at regulation, you also have to start looking at tying up the loose ends and the loopholes within the current legislation. And those particular, you cannot talk about an independent contractor with a labor broker when that person is completely, completely dependent most of the time on the farmer to supply transport. We've spoken to labor brokers in the research who had to ask for advances in order to go and fetch people or in order for them to be able to survive for the month. Now, that raises serious questions about the ability to negotiate. The issue that we haven't even dealt with as part of the labor landscape is the whole issue about safety and security. You have somebody who's going to come and work for you for a month. Now, you're already expensive to you to get that person or that group to be with you for a month, either accommodation or it's transport or it's local people. Now you still have to take time and pay them for the time of waiting to come in, whether it's 2 or 3 days, that you're supposed to be training them in the use of equipment, the use of pesticides, all the safety issues that they're supposed to do. We've had labor brokers saying to us, they don't even have the money and the time to do that. And that's a whole other issue that raises the risk phenomenally for workers. So when we start looking at all the different areas, we have to look at the pieces of legislation where those loopholes are still there and start tightening it up.
Thank you. Just one brief answer on this question. Are there any advantages in labor brokering from the side of the workers?
Currently, none. Really, it's only and when we ask workers why are they doing this work, it is literally out of desperation. They have no other alternative. So at the moment, there are no advantages for farm workers at all. I think the most advantages are for the farmer, who is able to circumvent the law, is able to circumvent all the logistics that are involved, and is also able to get out of any liability and so on. So at the end of the day, if I have to say who derives the most benefit, it is the farmer.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This is a continuation of the question that the Chair asked. I mean, you see, the issue of banning is clear. You take a decision, you ban, they are not there. Now, when you say regulation, how does regulation that you're talking about deal with the problems that you've raised? How does it deal with the worker who does not get the salary that you are supposed to get in terms of the sector determination? That's the issue that we've got to answer in terms of the proposal that we put on the table. Because most of the members that have spoken have said, we want to make sure that that employer, that farmer, is responsible for that non-payment. Whether the worker has got him hired through a labor broker, through whatever you call it, but the farmer should be responsible for that. If the worker is not paid, the farmer should be the one who's staying in the dock and who made the payment. Now, that's one way of dealing with it. Now, when you say regulation, I must say that the disadvantage is that I'm not sure whether the paper does deal with this issue. You're not coming up with how regulation will deal with that problem. Then you start saying, well, you must go into a partnership, you must go into this. I mean, you've got to be able to say, well, there's a typical problem. How do we deal with it? That typical problem of non-payment of wages that you've raised. How do workers that work in that area take that issue up through the regulation? That how would it make it easy? Remember, the Department of Labor, it doesn't matter what you do. It's not going to be able to put an inspector in each and every farm, in each and every factory, in each and every household in order to enforce the law. It's just like the police. You are not going to be able to have that. And therefore, you've got to have processes that will enable workers to be able to enforce also on their own the processes that you put on the table. Now, that's to me the shortcoming. I'm not sure whether it is in your paper. It explains it better in your paper, possibly wanting to read your paper. Also, on the issue of trade unions, if you look at what is it that we need to do to build up capacity of trade unions to organize in this sector. Is it in your paper? If I read your paper, would I see that part, that advice in terms of what do we need to do to ensure that we build organization? Because as a department, we see it as one of our responsibilities to build organization, because we believe that if we can build stronger organization in the sector, it will take off the pressure of the department.
Thank you, Mr. Otoa. Marapulunia Kemba.
Thank you very much. I think the speaker has tried to cover certain areas which I wanted. Because, you see, we can't continuously talk of regulation. What is it that has to be regulated? And I think at the same time, it's very much important that when you talk of regulation, you are not talking of a one-sided approach in terms of how do we think an issue has to be addressed. I'm saying this because a very key finding that you came up with in your research. Who is an employer? That is very clear. We can't run away from that fact. And now you look at any piece of legislation that we have, there's no definition of an employer. A definition that exists is an employer's organization. So the definition of an employer does not exist. But you will find a definition of an employee, and it's very clear and precise. And you will find a definition of a workplace. Now, in this scenario, Verma made the point here that how do you call the person who is operating in his or her car? Calling himself or herself a labor broker? What the laptop, the office that he has, is the car, and then the equipment is the laptop, and the water in the car is it? Then this person, and I think according to your presentation, your analysis of the existence of labor brokers in the sector where you conducted your research, it appears that is an exercise of outsourcing a certain function by a farmer. Because I will look at the farmer being a workplace, because that's where people work. They work in the farm. Now it becomes a workplace. Now this workplace doesn't want to take responsibility of employing personnel who must work in this workplace. And obviously, these individuals will be as defined by the labor legislation as employees. Now, they will become employees of the farmer. Now, the farmer is running away from the responsibilities. Then the best way of the farmer, according to the research, is that I must outsource or subcontract the employment of personnel. Now you will also have, even in the labor legislation, I mean, you alluded to that point, temporary employment service. It's not clear. It's not clear at all. You will look at it, Section 198 of the Act. It is defined in the Basic Constitutional Employment Act, but when you go to Section 198, it's not clear. It will tell you about the very same point which Velma raised earlier, human trafficking. Because you can't say, that means we're saying that, you can't say there are certain individuals who have a right to own others and regard human beings as a service. Because Section 198 specifically is supposed to deal with service. Where does the service will come from? Obviously, it will come from an independent contractor. Because an independent contractor will be a well-established body with its own equipment. It's like a contractor, for that matter, a building contractor. A building contractor is not somebody who says, I can put a block on top of a block, provided you bring me sand, cement, water, and other things, including a chopper. It's somebody who goes there with his or her tools to work on what that person is supposed to do. So I'm saying I'm not arguing against your preferred approach in the world matter, but I'm just raising certain issues which I think you did not look at, and this process obviously has to look at those issues also. Thank you.
Honorable Onis.
Thank you, Chairperson. I actually think that the two people who presented have done extraordinary research and probably among some very difficult conditions. So I think that what you've done is excellent. But I want to make a proposal, because often in this committee we sit and we criticize because we're trying to get to an answer by looking at other people's work. I want to propose something which is positive. So I'm not going to criticize. I'm just going to give an example of something I think might work. And I did it with a pen now, so it's not going to be perfect. Okay, there's going to be a few less imperfections. Let's say we could transform the industry, because that's the alternative. We either shut it down, as Cassandra wants, or we transform it. Those are the options. There are no other options. If we transform it, what could we do? And yeah, I want to make a suggestion, and because you know the particular workers better than I do, you'll tell me yes or no. No, it's a dumb idea, or yes, it could work. If we do the regulation option, what could we do? Well, the first thing we could do is deal with these fly-by-night labor brokers, where the guy operates out of a car. You can regulate in such a way that you could say, first of all, a labor broker must have a physical domicilium office where the worker, where the Department of Labor, where the inspectors can go and inspect. In other words, if you don't have an office, you are not a labor broker and we will prosecute you. We will find you, we will arrest you, we will prosecute you because you don't have an office. Once you put that in the legislation, then the next lot of things follow. Not only do you have to have an office, but you have to have records to prove that you are deducting UIF and compensation. You have to prove that you're paying it over. You have to prove that you are complying with all the other legislation that every other business has to comply with. The effect of that is that the inspectors don't have to go and look under a bush to find the labor broker. They know where to find him. You can then add a provision that labor broker must register, not only as a company or an organization, but actually must register on a register of labor brokers, where there is a list, a formal list, and the department has that list in their office. And if you are not one of those listed under the name, you are an illegal business, and the government may shut you down. And we have the police and the courts and the Department of Labor to send inspectors to shut them down. It makes the problem more manageable, so that the inspectors that are there can actually do their inspection, because the offices are registered, they're listed with the department, they've got a physical domicilium so you can find them, they can't run away. It's a registered business. And it takes people who are operating in the industry, and it regularizes them. It forces them to identify themselves. It forces them to prove with documentary evidence that they're doing the job. And you can then enforce the minimum wage level at a physical place. You can go to that place and say, show me the slips that you paid salary to your workers. Where is the bank statement? Where is the receipt? Where is the employee's salary advice? I want a copy. And the departments can go and ask for those copies. You see, you regularize the industry and you control it. It will reduce the labor brokers from maybe, I don't know how many there are. Do you know how many there are in the country? 100,000? Let's say it's 100,000. You reduce it from 100,000 to 5,000. Much easier to police. It's much easier to control. It's much easier to protect the workers whose rights are being eroded, because you know where to look. You have got documentary proof to check whether the workers are being exploited. You don't have to go with a torch and look under a bush and find somewhere. It's documented. There's a physical office. They're complying with the law. And then you can have a situation where, whether it's in the farmland in the Western Cape or whether it is the office in Sandton that we keep talking about, both have to comply. Both have got a physical place to inspect. Both have got to comply with all the regulations, including a minimum wage, which the minister can determine. The minister can then determine a minimum wage and say, you may not pay less than so much a day. I don't know what that number is. Do you see what I'm saying? The union has easier access to those people because they know where to look. So I'm suggesting that there is another way. Instead of doing the Namibia route and banning them, which costs a lot of people their jobs, we could go a South African route where we can regulate with specific details. Not just changing one word in the legislation to say, well, you know, the place of work must be defined and the employer must be defined, which I think we must do. And I actually agree with you on this specifically. But I think we can go further than that. We can create a category of labor brokers that can be controlled, that can be inspected and monitored by the department, because there's fewer of them than in a physical office. So you can put all those things into legislation. You can require them to do all of those things. And then you've got some people still finding work on behalf of others. And then it's no longer trafficking, because you can control it. You can inspect them. You can sue them. You can take them to court. You can lock them in prison because you know where to find them. The problem to me at the moment seems you don't know where to find these people. You have to employ NGOs to go sneak around with a torch and find them. And I'm trying to say there's an alternative to regulate, where you can find them, because they have to register with you as the department with their phone number, with their physical address, with their ID number, with their name, with their tax certificate, like a normal company, and you can find them. That's my suggestion.
Thank you, Honorable colleagues. I think we have come to the end of this discussion today, and I just want to say, it is not out of the blue that the committee has decided to look into this problem of labor brokers. There's a thorough research that has been done, I think by the Department of Labor under the supervision of the minister, looking at this issue. In particular, you see, the issue of labor brokering, it's not a national phenomenon, it's not a South African condition, it's a global issue. And in most cases, which is the result of a number of issues. For instance, we know in South Africa, don't want to go abroad in South Africa, the number of factories or companies that they close. They close and
opt for this labor brokering. Some of them retrench workers and opt for the labor brokering. It is easy to get workers in this manner because you can easily dodge the basic conditions of employment that are enshrined in the Labor Relations Act. Not only the basic conditions of employment in the Labor Relations Act, but also the basic conditions of simple dignity of workers, respect. Because in that process, there is somebody in between. There is no, if we don't talk, there's no labor brokering if there is no somebody in between. Why do these labor brokers, these people, the third parties, don't directly employ workers? Why do they need, the question that we should ask, why do they need that middleman instead of directly dealing with the workers? Why would companies close or retrench workers and opt for that option of labor brokering? That's the question that we should answer here before we can say we want to, let's think whether we should regulate or whether we should leave. What is the main problem with this labor brokering? It's the most brutal system. The researchers have just told us the most brutal system or method that is used to undermine workers and all their rights. It's another form of slavery. Because you have no right. In most cases, these workers can't talk for themselves because the person who's in the middle is the person who deals with the third party. And that is why, at the end of the day, when those workers die or get injured in the factory, nobody wants to take responsibility. Because some workers don't even know that they are not employed by this labor broker. There's a confusion as to who is employer. And I agree with Honorable Nyagama that we have to look. It's important to know who is a worker. I mean, who is an employee and an employer. Because in that Section 5 of Labor Relations Act, Section 78, the definition of an employee is given. And that employee, it says that a person who's employed in a workplace. Where is the workplace of a labor broker? The labor broker have no workplaces. They don't own workplaces. A person with a workplace is a third party. So I'm trying to say that I think all our views are welcomed because we are in a process of doing the right thing at the end of the day. So at this stage, we can't close people when they say, if you, for instance, feel that they should not be banned, we will listen. There are a number of people who will be coming next week and tell us what is that they think about the labor brokering. But I think we have to look into a number of questions. I think the basic question is, what benefits out of this system? Who is the beneficiary out of the system? Is it the workers, the vulnerable workers, that as members of parliament would like to present, to represent? Who suffers most in this system, and how do we deal with that? So I think those are issues that we should take into consideration. With those few words, I declare the meeting adjourned.
Thank you.